Our guest this morning on Santa Fe Radio Cafe is Michael Coleman of the Albuquerque Journal, the journal's Washington bureau chief, who recently wrote a three-part series called Mission Creep about the explosive growth in both budget and personnel and influence of the Department of Homeland Security and its implications for those of us who live in New Mexico. Michael, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
Michael, give me an outline. Just how explosive has the growth in this agency been in, what, 11 years since it was created?
It's been, I think explosive is a pretty good word. Just looking at their budget alone, their budget has doubled from $29 billion in their first year of existence in 2003 to just over $60 billion at this time. They've also added 60,000 new employees since the agency's inception. So they now have more than 240,000 Homeland Security Department employees across the country. And that's caused for a lot of concern, not only among budget watchdogs, but some civil libertarians and people like that. And I even had Tom Ridge, the first Secretary of Homeland Security, questioning what this was all about.
We'll get to that, but the fact that the personnel has grown by a third and the budget has more than doubled, what explains that? Where's all that extra money going?
Well, a lot of it's coming. Some of it's been driven by extra border security, which does, kind of lend itself to the department's original mission. But another part of it is just that there have been a growing number of Department of Homeland Security grants to states and cities and things like that to purchase various equipment. They've got these things called fusion centers now. There were, a couple dozen when they first started. Now they're almost 80. So pretty much anywhere you look across the Department of Homeland Security, you're seeing growth.
So this money that is spent outside of Washington and really outside of the Department of Homeland Security is what you might call seed money. It seeds outside projects, but perhaps even more important, it seeds support among Congress who love programs that pop up in their own home districts.
Oh, yeah, you got that right. There's nothing more they like than to issue a press release saying they're bringing home some bacon to the state. And, depending on your viewpoint, whether this is a good expenditure of money is a whole other question. But there's no doubt that members of Congress have not done much to slow the growth of the department's budget. And you're right, it does seed programs also at the state and city level that need to be continued. So, that continues to cost taxpayer dollars down the road.
Let's look at some of those programs in a moment. But first, after 11 years, has anybody at the department ever clearly defined what its purpose is?
No, they haven't. And that's one of the biggest, one of the most sort of glaring problems that was noted in our series. And then the Congressional Research Service noted it about a year ago that, 11 years into their existence, they still don't have a single unifying definition for Homeland Security. And obviously that leaves it open to all sorts of interpretations depending on, who is at the helm, who's the secretary of the department, who the deputies are, what Congress wants, that kind of thing. So it's an amorphous situation that, the current secretary says he's trying to get a handle on. And so we'll wait and see, how he does it and whether that actually happens.
The department has its fingers in many pies and, as you say, doesn't have a clearly stated purpose for what it's supposed to do. Does it have a clearly developed strategy for how it's going to do whatever it is it says it's going to do?
Good question. I think you really have to go and look at, the roles and responsibilities of the various 22 agencies that they merged together to create this department. FEMA's got its own objective. Customs and Border Protection's doing their thing. Immigrations and Customs Enforcement is doing their thing, which also includes Homeland Security Investigations, which I spent all of day two basically looking at. And that's a whole new unit, relatively new unit, a few years that's been in place. And, they're taking over a lot of law enforcement roles. Local law enforcement types of roles. So it really just depends on the agency you look at, and I'm sure some of their missions and objectives are better defined than others, but the department as a whole does not have any such clarification.
And I guess a perfect mirror of Homeland Security as a department of a million semi-missions is that it's also a department that is overseen by, well, not a million, but more than a dozen different congressional committees. Does this cause confusion?
Absolutely. It's actually more than 100 congressional committees and subcommittees now have some sort of jurisdiction over Homeland Security. There have been discussion over the years about trying to rein that in, but it just continues to grow. And I think that's in large part because, you know, members, there's a lot of money in the pot here, and members of Congress and committees want access and say over how that money is spent. So what you get is you're adding more and more oversight instead of less, and that really kind of muddies the mission because the Department of Homeland Security is getting directors from a lot of different places. And, you know, I sort of sympathize with them in the sense that, you know, it's they've got just way too many people telling them what to do, it seems.
With more than 100 different inputs of oversight, I'm going to guess that there is no focused oversight.
They're not really. They do have a House and Senate Homeland Security committees, and they do kind of overview look, you know, at their overall budget, and they'll, you know, bring in various directors and things to talk about stuff. But, you know, I think the Appropriations Committee, the Homeland Security Subcommittee for Appropriations, is probably a good place to look and see, you know, where the real priorities are. You look at where the money's being spent. But overall, the broad consensus is that the congressional oversight of Homeland Security is a mess.
What it also practically guarantees is that the head of the agency, in this case the former Navy counsel Jay Johnson, spends an awful lot of time simply testifying, more or less overlappingly, to all of these different oversight committees.
No question about it. I think, and he's been on the job since December, and you know, they've called him up to the Hill multiple times. I couldn't tell you how many, but if you look in the news, you'll see him, you know, talking to this committee, this subcommittee, and it does kind of make you wonder traveling between the headquarters and Capitol Hill, how they ever really get much work done in their office.
Yeah, it's not to say that any one of these committee hearings is a waste of time, but certainly every one of them is a distraction from actually doing his job.
That's correct. That's correct. And I think that Secretary Johnson wants to do his job. I mean, I have not met him, but I've talked to some people about him, and there are some people who feel who know about these things, who think his heart's in the right place, so to speak, and that he's a very competent guy. I've got a hold of a memo this week that shows he's looking to address some of the very issues that we outlined in our series about mission, and, you know, trying to streamline the department's focus and get people on board across the different agencies. So that's promising.
And not only is the boss of the agency spending an inordinate amount of time talking with Congress, the people just below him, the people who are actually administering the agency, there are a lot of them who simply aren't there or are temps.
That's right. Yeah. There were 13 top-level administrators, positions that are either vacant or in an acting director kind of mode. So when you have a lack of leadership at the top of various agencies, it makes it really difficult to set policy and get everybody moving in the right direction. And that's another thing we address in day one of the series, that there is a massive leadership vacuum at the department. And there's also a major morale problem. For the last 2 years, they were recognized by the Office of Personnel Management Statistics as having the worst morale of any federal agency in the government.
Yeah, there's one way that the trickle-down theory is absolutely not a theory but a law. If the bosses are not there or are distracted, the workers are simply not getting led, and this makes them frightened and unhappy.
I think that's right, and they've been sort of there have been a lot of questions about their effectiveness and all of that. You know, it's certainly valid, and we just did a big series about it. But I think that also has a drag on morale, and, you know, I think they feel a little bit unappreciated and under siege.
It is remarkable that the first Secretary of Homeland Security, the former Pennsylvania Governor Tom Ridge, told you, quote, "They've kind of lost their way. the focus, the primary focus of the agency, he says, has been substantially diminished. In the polite circles of politics, that's really a sledgehammer.
It really is. And I've got to say, when I was talking with Secretary Ridge, we had a good conversation, at least, I don't know, half an hour, 40 minutes. I was very struck by his candor. That's something you see in Washington when people leave office and don't have to, aren't worried about getting reelected or getting appointed to anything again. And he's in that position now. But, you know, I appreciated his candor. And he, you know, he knows a lot about the department. He stood it up as the first secretary. And, you know, the big thing that he, the things that he were really concerned about is, number one, the number of just employees they're adding. And he thinks that maybe they've got so many people now, as he put it in my series, that they're, quote, making work, you know, going out and trying to find things to do to justify their budgets. I think there's some real evidence that that's the case. And he also, in our Day 3 series, when we talked about equipping these local police departments, was wondering, you know, why we need tanks and Humvees and some of this paramilitary-style equipment. He said that wasn't the role of Homeland Security in outfitting local communities this way, and he's alarmed by it.
So, number one secretary, Tom Ridge, says they've lost their way, they've lost their focus. His successor was Michael Chertoff, and I guess he's looked at the national map of subsidiary offices and says, this thing's out of control.
I didn't have a chance to talk with Secretary Chertoff, but I do know that under his leadership is when the fusion centers expanded. You know, we started out, Ridge said his goal was to have about 8 fusion centers. These are Homeland Security offices located in state in concert with the state government, basically to serve as a conduit from state to federal government, information sharing, that kind of thing. We've now got almost 80 of these things across the country, and you know, Ridge said he envisioned maybe 8 regional fusion centers, but you know, Chertoff expanded that greatly, for better or for worse. It depends on who you ask.
Number 3, Janet Napolitano, Jay Johnson's predecessor, wouldn't talk to you at all.
No, and I was a little disappointed by that because she's a New Mexico native, grew up in Albuquerque, and I think her brother's even was a scientist at Sandia. So I was hoping she'd talk to the local hometown paper, but she's at the University of California now, I guess, trying to you know, do her thing there. And yeah, I was disappointed she wouldn't talk because I thought she could shed some light on this. Obviously, a lot of this growth happened under her watch. Again, for better or for worse, some say that this administration's done a great job in terms of border security, and that's certainly where a lot of these extra numbers are coming from. But I would really like the opportunity to talk to her about it.
Well, one thing you might have mentioned is that in her old hometown, you pointed out that there are Department of Homeland Security people who are working with the pickpocket squad of the APD.
Yeah, I was surprised by that. I talked to Kevin Abar, who's in charge of Homeland Security investigations in New Mexico. Very forthcoming, candid interview. But, you know, and this is one of the things that kind of put me on this series, is just noticing over the past couple of years the various things that they're involved in. And, yes, one of the examples he gave was that APD was having some trouble with pickpockets at a Target store, and he thought, well, as he put it, it's really not in our wheelhouse, but we're going to go help them because they asked for it. So they sent some agents over there, and they busted up a ring, I guess, and did that. But, you know, a lot of people, including Secretary Ridge, are wondering, you know, why federal Homeland Security officers are working with local police. That's not all they're doing. They're going into senior centers and elementary schools to teach kids and old folks about the dangers lurking on the Internet. They met with some adult dancers and club owners to talk about the problems related to human trafficking. You know, all of these things, I guess you could say, could fall under the bailiwick of Homeland Security, but it's also really questionable whether it does.
Well, I mean, if Homeland Security got involved in trying to bust the hackers who undid Target's credit card system, that was a theft of such magnitude and that Homeland Security could conceivably be involved. But pickpockets working the parking lot or the store of Target, Homeland Security?
Yeah, that really raised a lot of eyebrows, I think. You know, and these guys, they truly believe that, you know, they're doing a service, and they may well be. I mean this is a shade of law enforcement, but the question is whether that's their role. And, you know, this is federal policing happening at a very local level. And, you know, there's historically been a real separation there. Not to mention that this is usually maybe the kind of stuff that, the FBI or, you know, your local police would be doing. So it's just a question of whether it's their role and where does it stop.
You know, I can't remember whether it's your phrase or somebody you quoted, but you noted that at Homeland Security, it sometimes seems that it is projects that drive and expand the budget rather than the normal process of you look at your budget and see what projects you can afford.
That's right. That came from a Congressional Research Service report, and I thought that that was really eye-opening. The quote is that there's no clarity in the national strategies of federal, state, and local roles and responsibilities, and potentially the funding is driving priorities rather than priorities driving the funding. I thought that was very eye-opening and illuminating observation by the Congressional Research Service, which is nonpartisan, in my experience, excellent in terms of their research.
You mentioned your interview with Kevin Abar, the Assistant Special Agent for Homeland Security Investigations in New Mexico, and he told you, quote, "I really do want to expand the footprint as far as my side of Homeland Security." Did he give you any sense of how far beyond the pickpocket squad he wants to go?
You know, he did make the case that they are basically, and he said in my story, literally working side by side with officers and police departments around the state. You know, they're helping to find stolen Native American art, things like that. So it seemed to me from talking to Mr. Abar that the sky is really the limit, and that they want to help law enforcement in New Mexico as much as possible, and would really be willing to do pretty much anything police departments ask.
You know, when you think about these things, you can see why local governments love them, because if DHS is sending people to augment the pickpocket squad, it means that APD doesn't have to, and it can use its personnel and its budget elsewhere, so that, again, we were talking about seeding support as well as projects. This is a perfect example of how this builds local support, even if it may be way beyond the original mandate of the Homeland Security Department.
Absolutely, and I think it's real tempting for these cash-strapped police departments and communities to accept this sort of help, accept these resources. But, you know, when they do that, they're also accepting or maybe ceding a certain amount of autonomy. And, you know, one of the values of having local police is that they know the community and, work local cases with an understanding of what's going on and the history of, even know some of the troublemakers and that kind of thing. And they're sort of a part of the community. Now the federal government's coming in and they don't really have that. I mean, they may get to the point where we have that, but then we've just got a federal police force in New Mexico.
Another quote from your story that I think sums up this problem very well is from Benjamin Friedman of the Cato Institute, a libertarian think tank of great influence in Washington. And he made two points. One is that, of course, Homeland Security can point to any one and every one of these micro programs and say that it's making America safer. But Friedman says, quote, "Perfect safety is an illusion. We could spend 10 times what we're spending and still not approach it." And then he notes, quote, "We're spending big bucks chasing some pretty small dangers."
Yeah, and I think a lot of people who look at the budget of the Homeland Security Department have that in mind. I mean, if somebody wants to, walk onto the plaza in downtown Albuquerque with some kind of a bomb or something, it's almost impossible to stop. I mean, we've got to be vigilant at our airports and our areas where terrorists are known to target. I don't think anybody disputes that. But then you have to just sort of question at some point, how many billions and billions and billions of dollars you're going to keep pouring into what is really just a shadowy and completely elusive threat.
Now, DHS may be doing too many projects that are too little, but this is not to say that they're a universal success on their biggest projects. You quoted an AP investigation from 2011 into DHS's plans to expand and upgrade the Coast Guard. 25 years, $24 billion budgeted for it, with the idea that dozens of vessels would be added to bring the Coast Guard up to 250. Now, two new ships have been funded with $7 billion, so almost a third of the budget is gone, and the goal seems pretty far out of sight.
It's really staggering. It is when you look at the numbers, and I think a big part of what drives this, obviously, is the private contracting. They get these giant contracts, and they come in over budget and late. And I just don't think there's enough oversight. One of the things that Ridge and I talked about, and I didn't really have a lot of space to get into, was that he thinks the DHS procurement is a mess. I don't think anybody could really argue against that with any real credence. So, that's another thing that maybe, Congress could take a look at. But then you got the whole question of, who are they taking money from? A lot of them, they're taking money from the very contractors who were part of the problem. So it's a deeply rooted issue that's been plaguing our government and the Defense Department for years, and it's certainly crept into Homeland Security as well, it seems.
So even if we worry about the new stuff that they're buying, a lot of the DHS programs raise the question, would you buy a used tank or MRAP from these guys? And you note that the re-equipping of local law enforcement with a lot of abandoned equipment from our military missions in Afghanistan and Iraq, may start to distort the tactics of local police departments as they integrate these APCs and super reinforced MRAPs and even other tank-like vehicles or hard-to-operate Humvees into what had been their standard equipment at the garage.
Right, and I think that a lot of civil libertarians are looking at this with real wariness. There was a thing in a quote in my story about this militarization about a community in Keene, New Hampshire, and the police department wanted to buy about a $300,000 little mini tank, for lack of a better word, and the community rallied against it. They'd only had one murder in that town in the past 2 years, and I've been there. It's actually a very beautiful little picturesque New England town, and the community banded together, and they said, let's do that. And they printed up some shirts that said, thanks, but no tanks. And police department went ahead with the purchase, and the chief said that it could be used to patrol the annual pumpkin festival there in New Hampshire, which obviously sounds pretty ridiculous. It's a new day and a new look for police departments across America, it seems to me. It's just a lot more intimidating, a lot more militarized appearing, and it's happening everywhere, not just in New Mexico.
In Farmington, if I'm remembering correctly, they have up-armored.
That's right. Up-armored was a word that Kevin Abar used in speaking about Homeland Security Investigations presence and expanding presence in New Mexico. But Farmington, Hobbs, several of these communities have gotten these military-style tanks that were used in Iraq and Afghanistan. They're called MRAPs. The exact acronym, the words in the acronym are escaping me right now. But basically, about a $600,000, $700,000 vehicle. They stand 11 foot high, and they're armored and obviously bulletproof and all this kind of thing. But some of these small communities are getting them, and they're getting them for a song. About $3,000, I think it was, to transport it to Farmington. So they've got this $700,000 vehicle for $3,000, but they're going to have to maintain it over the years, and that's no easy feat. So that's going to eventually eat into the local police budget, and it's just a question of judgment. Do these small towns and communities really need them? The cops say they do. They say that it helps in SWAT situations. It helps keep people safe. Other people think it's over the top and intimidating and a little bit off-putting.
Well, MRAP is mine-resistant, armored platform.
Thank you. Yep.
And it was built to defend troops, mostly in Iraq and later in Afghanistan, not just against your ordinary IEDs, but the shaped rounds that the Iranians taught the Iraqis to use several years in. I don't think IEDs, much less shaped rounds, are a big problem in Farmington.
Yeah, I don't think so either. I haven't heard if it is, and we got a whole other story if that's becoming the trend with criminals. But you know, I agree. I'm not sure that a lot of people would think there's a lot of utility for that in some of these small towns, much less maybe even Albuquerque.
And as you pointed out, the song may be over, but the melody lingers on. When you absorb new equipment like this, especially exotic new equipment, for the first thing, you got to train everybody in the department how to use it.
Right, right. And, you know, I get the sense from my research and reading and talking to some people that, you know, a lot of police and especially recruits that are coming to these departments, that's part of the appeal of becoming a police officer these days is you get to play with these, as you put it, exotic kind of toys. And, you know, if you look at some of these videos, the recruiting videos that are out there now, they almost have a kind of video game quality to them. Lots of paramilitary uniforms and automatic weapons, and it looks like a big shoot 'em up, you know, fun time. But and it just strikes me as a much different place than we used to be with, you know, our police officers generally dressed in blue and kind of looking to serve rather than confront.
I'm Dave Marish, sitting in for Mary Charlotte. My guest on the Radio Cafe this morning is Michael Coleman, the Washington Bureau Chief for the Albuquerque Journal. We'll be back with Michael after a short break. Welcome back to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. I'm Dave Marish, sitting in for Mary Charlotte. And my guest is Michael Coleman, the Albuquerque Journal's Washington Bureau Chief. You know, the great breakthrough in policing of about 10 or 15 years ago was community policing, where the idea was that you kind of demystified your police and you took away a lot of the armor that separated them from the citizens whom they were policing, and you got them out of their squad cars and walking beats, and you did not have them in riot gear, but in ordinary uniforms, so that the idea was that communities would bond with the police, collaborate with the police, inform the police of problems before they happen. All of this up-armoring seems to be a radical 100-degree turn away from community policing.
It really does. And even that term up-armoring was a term that Mr. Abar used in my interview with him, and I just had to stop him. I said, well, wait, what does that mean? And he said, you know, it's basically just more resources and more people on the ground, but it certainly leaves the impression or the connotation that, you know, we're armoring, we're ready for battle. And, you know, that's fine, I guess, if you're dealing with criminals. But in the meantime, I think it intimidates regular citizens who might, you know, otherwise, you know, I just hear more and more, and it's sad because I think there are a lot of good cops and their mission, their purpose is obviously very important. But more and more people that I talk to these days in the course of this series, in the course of talking to people in Albuquerque, they're afraid of their police departments. And I don't know that, you know, military-style dress and tanks is going to do much to mitigate that problem.
And again, in addition to the costs of training, there's a tremendous maintenance tail on these things. They are expensive to keep running. They are built for battlefield conditions with a handy logistics unit always on hand to bring them back into shape. A lot of police departments accept these as almost gifts and then discover that the budget drag of this freebie is actually huge.
I assume that's the case. Honestly, I have not looked into what maintenance costs are and what, you know, I think a lot of this is kind of new. So, you know, it may be something for us or our police reporters to take a look at as we move forward. You know, what kind of money they're spending on this. I Secretary Ridge told me that he thinks it's going to be very substantial.
In addition to the military equipment, you noted it, and so have the Department of Justice investigators, that a military mentality seems to be infecting our local police and our state police. The newest training regime for the State Department of Public Safety is very heavy on the military attitude of when you approach a situation, assume that everyone could be life-threatening. Hey, this is New Mexico, not Iraq.
Right, right. And, you know, I'm not aware of what the state of New Mexico is doing as far as military-style training goes. I would not be surprised at all. It seems to be a trend. In the course of my research, I did come across in Columbia, South Carolina, Earlier this year, the Richland County Sheriff's Department was actually doing training exercises with some of the elite Army fighters at Fort Bragg. So apparently now we have our military training our police. So I guess that would answer the question as to whether they're engaging in military-style training.
And actually, since a lot of the newest recruits to police departments in New Mexico and around the country are people with recent military experience in Iraq or Afghanistan, reprogramming them to take a military approach would seem to me to be exactly the wrong direction. You actually want to deprogram them of their military instincts and say, no, your job is different. You are now on friendly turf and you are policing in a civil way. This is not to say that there aren't dangers constantly on the job, but that the police approach should be something like the Hippocratic Oath. First, do no harm.
Right, right. Now, I think that there's a fundamental difference between being in the military and being on a police force. In the military, you're engaging in combat. That's established. That's baseline. That's what we're here to fight. The police department's here ostensibly there first to serve and then protect and then fight if you have to. And so it's a different mindset, but they do seem to be merging. And, obviously the police departments around the country are recruiting a lot of veterans, and I think that is, our veterans who served admirably in foreign wars certainly deserve employment, and if they want to work for police departments, more power to them. But I think your point about sort of, trying to reprogram the mindset is probably a valid one.
Now, we've talked a little bit about the mine-resistant armored vehicles coming into Farmington, the assistance for the pickpocket squad of the Albuquerque Police Department. Where else have you found DHS fingerprints on law enforcement keeping the peace in New Mexico?
Well, aside from the millions of dollars they're sending to the state and various states every year to buy equipment, a lot of that I covered in day two, and a lot of what I saw, the growth, obviously there's been growth on the border. We've added thousands of new Border Patrol agents across our border with Mexico. I don't think very many people really take issue with that. That's certainly in line with the mission of the Department of Homeland Security, protecting our borders, making sure terrorists and other bad guys don't get into the country. There's been an expansion there. But I think that the biggest expansion that's happening right now is happening with Homeland Security investigations and what they're doing in police departments and the Attorney General's office throughout the state. Again, going back to our previous discussion, just taking on some roles that a lot of people find somewhat questionable, whether it's worth the money for us to have federal agents going into elementary schools to teach kids about the dangers of the Internet. Surely somebody else could do that. Helping to sleuth for Native American art, stolen Native American art. It's an important issue in New Mexico and to the art economy, but I'm not, a lot of people may wonder if that's really the federal role. So really, I think the biggest eye-opening expansion that I came across was what's happening with Homeland Security investigations out of Albuquerque.
And did Kevin Abar have any, for instances, or propositions in mind when he said he'd like to expand operations of DHS inside New Mexico?
No, it was really not as far as initiatives or certain programs. I think it was really more about, getting a presence in various local police departments and, helping to work cases. He's very sincere and genuine in terms of what he's doing. He thinks that the federal government can help a poor state, vast geographic area do a better job of law enforcement. They're also doing a lot of gang activity. They just announced today or yesterday that they had arrested hundreds of gang members across the country, and I haven't had a chance to look at that real closely, but they're doing gang interdiction. It really doesn't sound like there's much they won't do, and I didn't get a real clear sense as to whether the Homeland Security Department's imposing itself on cities and police departments, or it's the other way around. I know that I talked to APD and they said they welcome the help, but again, that goes back to the resources and the money that the feds are giving them, and then the question is, where does it end, and are you giving up some of your autonomy in the bargain?
Well, to paraphrase paraphrase the old Hank Williams song, if you've got the money, honey, we've got the needs.
That's about right. Exactly. Exactly.
Michael, tell me a little bit. Let's do a little meta reporting here. How did you first tumble to this story? What were some of the first things that you noticed that made you say, boy, there's a story here, and in fact, it's such a good story, I could sell my editors on a three-part series?
Well, it was an evolution. I started looking at the Homeland Security budget almost a year ago, and I noticed that they had over 100% increase in, and actually I started into this looking at what Homeland Security is doing in comparison to what the our national laboratories are doing with respect to technology, you know, mine sweepers, and, you know, our labs make all these really cool gizmos to help with national security, and I look sometimes at DHS to see, well, what are they doing, and is there some overlap here? And I noticed this giant increase in technology spending. So I started asking about that, and I noticed, well, wait a minute, the whole department's budget has doubled. And in the meantime, we're getting this kind of dribs and drabs of press releases from HSI about all the stuff they're doing in the state, you know, that they're meeting with, you know, adult dancers. Well, that's interesting. And that they're, you know, busting stolen art stuff. Okay. And then my editor, Kent Walsh, pointed out that they had just built this elaborate headquarters out at Mesa del Sol, just south of Albuquerque. So Ken just told me, you know, hey, let's take a look at this. He said, just go see what you find. And, you know, after I had sort of brought up the budget stuff, and once we started looking at it, it just kind of snowballed from there. And, you know, this militarization issue really started coming to the forefront. And it turns out that Homeland Security's providing a lot of money for that to happen. So I started asking questions of the Albuquerque Police Department and the State Homeland Security Department. What are you doing with this money? And so eventually it sort of coalesced into what I thought would make a good three-part series. The first part looking at the national overview and what are they doing with their budget, leadership vacuum, lack of congressional oversight. Second part looking at what Homeland Security agents are actually doing on the ground in our state. And then the third part looking at where this Homeland Security grant money for police departments is going. And on that third count, I should mention that I tried really hard to track who's getting what and what they're spending it on, and it was virtually impossible. The Federal Department of Homeland Security referred me to the state. The state gave me a dollar amount. It was about $28 million they get for they got this year for law enforcement and for disaster mitigation stuff and natural disasters and things like that. But it's about $28 million, and in large part they couldn't tell me where it went or how it was spent. So that's a little bit alarming as well. There should be some accountability for this money.
Well, it would certainly be good public relations for them, you would think, to give us some sense of how much DHS has got investment in contracts at Sandia Labs, which certainly for motion detection, border security, that kind of high-techery is probably number one in the country.
Yeah, it probably is. And, you know, I got to think that at some point they're going to have to tighten their controls. You know, the Department of Homeland Security's own Inspector General was just demoted or let go last week for being, you know, not doing his job, being way too cozy with the various department heads and things like that. So even in-house at the Department of Homeland Security, it seemed like the watchdog was asleep. So, you know, all of this cumulatively hopefully will get somebody's attention, and, you know, maybe they'll shake them out of their malaise and start saying, hey, you've got to account for these billions of dollars you're spending.
You know, you mentioned that they have this program to alert students and the elderly to problems on the Internet. You can't think about national security and the Internet without thinking about the surveillance programs of the NSA, the National Security Agency. Did you learn anything about any kinds of links and cooperations between DHS and NSA?
I did not. No, I really didn't. The only link that I'm aware of is that Michael Chertoff and Michael Hayden are now partners at the Chertoff Group in downtown, a security firm, security consulting firm. So those two guys know each other pretty well, and they're doing business together. But I didn't really get into what the NSA is doing. That's obviously a whole other operation that's gotten a massive amount of attention in the past year, rightly so, but I did not come across much overlap.
And, of course, Michael Hayden has joined our business. He's now to be a columnist on the Washington Times.
I didn't know that, but I'm not surprised. I actually did a profile of Michael Hayden a few months ago. It's been about 6 months ago, and talked to him about some of the stuff that was happening with Edward Snowden and all that kind of stuff. Interesting guy, but I did not realize he was being a columnist. Now I'm not surprised, though.
Did you find any links and programs beyond the Pickpocket Squad between Homeland Security and the Albuquerque Police Department?
They say they've got a guy working in-house with them, and a lot of what he's doing is background checks and things like that. They were a little bit vague, but that's just one area. And, you know, I asked them if they were involved, for example, in the response to the massive protest that happened after the gentleman was killed out in the Sandia foothills, but they wouldn't tell me whether they're involved in that or not. I get the sense that Homeland Security and APD work very closely.
You know, there's a very interesting chicken and egg question about that. The protests, of course, started quite peacefully that day down Central Avenue from the UNM campus, and at a fairly early point when things were still, there was some shouting going on, but no manifestations of violence at all. The APD responded in full riot gear, battle helmets, shields, batons. Later on, of course, there was violence. There was stone throwing. There was an attack on the police substation at Central and Girard. And then in the last hours of it, things seemed to get even more out of control. But you do wonder whether the police response, which seemed maybe to be an over-response to what they were dealing with at the time, may have been as much a provocation as a control.
You know, I wonder about that. I wasn't there, but I was following it on Twitter really closely, and it seemed to me that there were quite a few protesters out there who were interested in doing a little bit more than protesting, that they were, really being disruptive, and you know, ultimately it certainly escalated into some vandalism and things like that. And I quoted a former police officer who now is a professor of Homeland Security, who said that he's kind of been on both sides of the street with respect to that. When you've got a massive, tense group of protesters, it doesn't do a lot of good to just show up with a couple of cops on bikes or something like that, I think was his quote. And that you need to, there are times when a overwhelming display of force is necessary. Whether that added fuel to an already, smoking situation, I don't know.
Well, I actually was there, and at the point that the riot troops arrived in full regalia, there wasn't much smoke and there wasn't much violence. And in fact, it looked to me like many of the students were just flat shocked to suddenly be confronted by, what looked like a force protecting the president's mansion from rioters. Now, certainly there were rioters in the crowd, but you wonder whether the police presence didn't give them credibility.
Could be. Yeah, I don't know. There's a lot of anti-law enforcement sentiment, certainly in New Mexico these days, and having that kind of intimidating presence certainly antagonizes certain elements. But, I've covered protests in my day, and I know there are also people who show up and they're really just looking to make some trouble. So it's a balance. I think it's a tough balance for police in that situation, but it does sound like it got pretty hairy and it was unfortunate. Tear gas was dispersed and all of that kind of stuff. Nobody likes to see that.
Exactly right. I guess the question that I would ask, and can't really ask it of you, but I would ask it of the professor, is whether the proposition of your choice being between a couple of cops on bicycles and the fully militarized SWAT team, that there might be a middle way between those might not be the only two choices.
Right, I think that's probably a right on spot observation.
Michael, where do you go next on a story like this?
Well, that's a good question. I think I mentioned earlier in our interview that I got an internal memo the other day that I'm going to write about for the weekend that Jay Johnson, the Secretary of Homeland Security, is looking to do some reorganizing or at least streamlining of department functions and try to clarify that mission. So I think that's one place that I'll be looking. I got a call from the Senate Homeland Security Committee. Top staffer over there said they read the series with great interest, and you know they're looking. And he basically told me that as the department heads into its next decade, defining its mission, refining its mission, is the number one priority, at least of that committee, and that they get the sense that that's Johnson's goal as well. So you know we'll follow that real closely, and I think it's also important that we follow, even if it's our reporters on the ground in New Mexico, you know what they're doing in our state. Where they're putting those resources and what the trade-off is.
Sound like there's riveting reading ahead. And Michael Coleman, congratulations on a flat terrific three-part series, Mission Creep, on the growth of the Department of Homeland Security and its increasing influence on law enforcement inside the state of New Mexico. Mike, thanks so much for joining us. It's really been great talking with you.
Thank you, David. I really appreciate it. And I love KSFR. Every time I'm back in town, that's where I tune it. So I look forward to being back in New Mexico again soon. And thank you for having me on. I really appreciate that.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. I'm Dave Marish, sitting in for Mary Charlotte.